This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. It's been nearly 50 years since the U.S. and Soviet Union first sat down to talk about limiting their arsenals of nuclear weapons. Today, Russia and the U.S. have reduced their stockpiles, but they still have nearly 2,000 warheads each, and several other countries have shown interest in creating or expanding their nuclear arsenals. So how do we gauge the threat of nuclear conflict, and what would nuclear war look like if there were one limited to a region, one region in the world? Dr. Ira Helfand has been researching those questions. He's a physician and the co-president of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. He's going to speak about limited nuclear war at the FedEx Global Education Center at UNC Chapel Hill Monday night at 7:30. But first, he joins me on the State of Things. Dr. Helfand, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
You say the greatest threat to us today on the planet as a species is nuclear war. Why?
Well, because nuclear war is the one thing which can really destroy our civilization. I think the other great threat is climate change. This is something that is going to happen slowly, gradually over the next century if we don't take action. Nuclear war could happen this afternoon. And we have acted since the end of the Cold War, so this danger has completely gone away. But it hasn't. The weapons are still out there. They're still in the hands of governments which don't always get along very well with each other and which threaten on occasion to use these weapons. And if there is a nuclear war, it's going to be sudden and it's going to represent a catastrophe from which our civilization will not recover.
I think the reason, it seems to me, if we are less concerned today than we were at the peak of the Cold War about this, is that it seems to many people that the plausibility of nuclear war has shrunk to nearly nothing. Would you say that's true?
No, that's completely false, and that's actually a very great mistake that we all make and at our great peril. There are a number of scenarios in which nuclear war could take place very possibly in the near term. The most alarming probably in terms of its probability is the situation in South Asia between India and Pakistan. These countries each have about 200 nuclear warheads, and they are in a state of constant hostility. There's been fighting daily on the line of demarcation between India and Pakistan in Kashmir for the last year and a half. And Pakistan in particular is a very unstable country. There are many different scenarios under which the rivalry between these countries could lead to war and to the use of nuclear weapons.
Well, spell those out for us because, you know, during the Cold War we had this mad concept of mutual assured destruction. Crazy as it was, it seemed to be effective that these two nations halfway around the globe from each other could not conceive of using this lightly because of the assurance that they too would be destroyed. In a regional conflict, you're talking about India and Pakistan, that assurance, if it can be even greater, is certainly more powerful. Would either of those, given the devastation and destruction it would cause either of those countries, India and Pakistan, could they even conceive of using weapons in a war against each other?
Oh, they actually do actively conceive of using them. They both have military doctrines that describe the conditions under which they would use nuclear weapons against the other side. In the case of Pakistan in particular, which is much weaker in terms of conventional weapons, Pakistani nuclear doctrine calls for the relatively early use of nuclear weapons in the event of a war with India. And I think in that context, it's important to reflect back for a minute on the observation you just made about mutually assured destruction. This was not a system which guaranteed that nuclear weapons would not be used. And in fact, we came unbelievably close to using nuclear weapons during the Cold War on many occasions, as we have come close to using them, the U.S. and Russia, since the end of the Cold War on at least one occasion. And so this notion that the threat of destruction is an adequate deterrence to keep the weapons from being used is simply not true. We have been incredibly, incredibly lucky over the last 70 years that these weapons have not been used. And we have to understand that. People tried to behave rationally. They tried to make sure the weapons wouldn't be used. But when you look at it, the bottom line is we've been unbelievably lucky. And a continued reliance on good luck is simply not an acceptable policy for the U.S. and Russia, or for India and Pakistan, or for any other nuclear power.
Your group was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985 for supporting a reduction in nuclear arsenals. Give us a sense of how the global conversation, or just even here in the United States, how the conversation about nuclear arms has changed since 1985.
Well, you know, at the height of the Cold War, there was a very palpable sense of the danger that we faced. Millions of people around the country understood that there could be a nuclear war at any moment, and they were right. When the Cold War ended, we so wanted to hope that this danger had gone away, that we basically just started acting as though it had. And so for a period of about almost 20 years, from 90 until 2010, there really was very little conversation about nuclear weapons here. There were some moments when the North Koreans tested their weapons, when the Indians and Pakistanis tested theirs, when people began to focus on this a little bit. But basically, people didn't want to hear about it. And there's still that's true still to a significant degree. But in the last few years, there has been some, fortunately, resurgence of awareness about the danger that these weapons pose. This has largely been due to the research we've done, I think, on limited nuclear war, which people do feel is more possible, more likely than a large-scale war between the U.S. and Russia. And what we have shown is that even a limited conflict between India and Pakistan, in which only a half of their current nuclear arsenals were used, that conflict would cause worldwide climate disruption that would negatively affect food production across the planet and put perhaps as many as 2 billion people at risk of starvation. So as that information has started to get out, it has affected many people's thinking, particularly many governments in the global south, which would bear the brunt of this nuclear famine. Here in the United States, the conversation has lagged a bit. We've not been as successful in getting this information into the public domain, which I think, frankly, is something of an indictment of the media in this country, which have tended to really been blind to the reality of the danger that we still face with nuclear weapons. The other issue, which has brought this a little bit more into people's consciousness, of course, is the conflict in Ukraine, which has highlighted the fact that the United States and Russia still are engaged or are again engaged in an adversarial relationship, which raises the possibility of conflict between them, armed conflict, which could get out of control and lead to the use of nuclear weapons. And this is, again, I think, focusing people's attention on what would happen if there were a large-scale nuclear war, which is still possible. As you pointed out, the U.S. and Russia each have about, at this point, 1,500 deployed nuclear warheads. Most of these are on high alert. They can be launched in less than 15 minutes. And if those weapons are used, the effect on world climate would be unbelievably catastrophic. Global temperatures dropped by about 8 degrees centigrade, which brings us to a point colder than the coldest point in the last ice age 18,000 years ago. For 3 years in the northern hemisphere, there would not be a single day free of frost. That means the temperature would go below freezing every single day. And that means there'd be no food production in the northern hemisphere. And the vast majority of the human race would starve to death. These consequences, we need to understand them. We need to know what's going to happen if our weapons are used. And we don't. And what's most alarming, I think, is that many of the people who are responsible for decisions about these weapons also don't really understand what's going to happen if they use the weapons at their disposal.
Well, let's talk, very, very dangerous situation.
Let's talk about what's happening in this country. The federal government plans to spend about $1 trillion over the next 30 years on the technology around nuclear weapons. First of all, what is that? We're not expanding our arsenal, so where is that money going?
It's largely going into building new delivery systems, replacing the bombers, replacing the submarines, spending a lot of money also on missile defense. This is an extraordinarily misguided effort. We are trying to convince the rest of the world that they should not acquire nuclear weapons. And then we announce that we're going to spend $1 trillion refurbishing our nuclear arsenal so that it will be useful for us, so that we will be able to use these weapons for decades into the future. The message we're sending the world is that we consider these weapons to be very valuable for our national security. I would argue that they're not, but the government is saying that they are. And that message is heard by the rest of the world. If they're valuable to the U.S., then why aren't they valuable to Iran or North Korea or any of the other countries that we're trying to convince not to build nuclear arsenals? So we have a choice. We either rely on nuclear weapons and see the rest of the world adopt that policy and begin building nuclear weapons, or we understand what I think is the correct view of this, that nuclear weapons, their existence anywhere in the world, is the greatest threat to our national security. And therefore, we need to do whatever we can to make sure that all the nuclear weapons in the world are gotten rid of, and that includes taking steps to get rid of our own.
Yeah, it does seem to me, though, that you're still in the same dilemma that we had at the peak of the Cold War, which is that unilateral disarmament by no means guarantees the other side is going to stand down. On the contrary, they would simply—
I'm not advocating unilateral disarmament, and I don't think anybody is.
Okay.
What we're advocating is that the United States lead the way in multilateral negotiations to secure a nuclear weapons convention that will set forward a very rigorous regime for verifiably and enforceably reducing all the nuclear arsenals in the world. I think it would be a mistake for the U.S. to disarm unilaterally. We need to do this with the other countries.
But isn't the genie out of the bottle already? The logic, it seems to me, is hard to forget and hard to put back in the bottle. And that is, if you have these weapons, you're a player, you're a dominant player, people have to take you seriously. If you don't have these weapons, you're a colony. And so does that change? How do you negotiate with that logic? Isn't that logic hard to disable? And how do you negotiate in the face of that?
That logic only pertains if some countries have nuclear weapons and other countries don't. If no one has nuclear weapons, then the playing field is leveled, and that's what we need to be aiming for. What we need to understand is that these weapons, if used, are basically suicide devices. The United States, if it were to launch a nuclear attack on another country, even if it were completely, quote, successful, the environmental damage, the climate disruption caused by a U.S. nuclear attack on another country would have catastrophic effects here in the United States. These are suicide weapons. We've become a nation of suicide bombers, and I don't think that's who we want to be. And it certainly does not enhance our security for us to be carrying suicide vests as we walk around the world.
How do you see those negotiations going? Again, during the Cold War, you had two superpowers, and the negotiations were largely between those two players. Now, as you say, regional conflicts. Israel has nuclear weapons. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. India has nuclear weapons, and South Africa. How do we go in and negotiate, given their tensions in their particular regions and their intransigence on issues regarding their regional security, as a player, you know, the United States or even Russia, for that matter?
Well, I think we are going to have to pay significant concern to the legitimate security concerns of countries around the world. The Israelis feel that their existence is threatened. The Pakistanis do as well. And we're going to have to address those concerns as part of this negotiation. But I think it's a mistake to say that they are the problem, that they are the obstacle. The obstacle to nuclear abolition, the principal obstacle, consists of the five permanent members of the Security Council, the so-called good guys, the right hands to hold nuclear weapons. They're the ones that have the vast majority of the nuclear weapons, and they're the ones that have steadfastly refused to give up their nuclear monopoly. The United States claims that it seeks the security of a world free of nuclear weapons, but as you pointed out just a few minutes ago, we're planning to spend $1 trillion to make sure we can continue to use nuclear weapons for decades into the future. In fact, it is not the policy of the United States to seek a world free of nuclear weapons. It is currently the policy of the United States to continue to have a nuclear arsenal forever. And that has to fundamentally change. I don't think the United States can act unilaterally, but I do think the United States, as the only remaining superpower, has to lead the way. And we have to understand we're not doing this to be, altruistic, to be generous to the world. We're doing this because it is in our national security interest. Sooner or later, if these weapons are not abolished, they are going to be used. And it is going to be a catastrophe for us.
Do you think in some ways we're even less safe than we were during the Cold War when, again, there were two superpowers with recognized governments kind of with their fingers on the buttons? Now the fact that terrorist groups in extraterritorial situations, they don't have state capitals, could not launch an attack but certainly set off a nuclear device, create one, and touch off a kind of nuclear war outside of a state capital. Does that make things even more dangerous in some ways?
I don't know if it makes things more dangerous, but it certainly makes things very, very, very dangerous. Terrorists or non-state actors could do a number of things. They could set off a nuclear explosion, perhaps. They could launch a cyber attack that convinces one of the existing nuclear powers that it is under attack and provokes the use of nuclear weapons by that country in the mistaken belief that it's facing a nuclear attack against itself. It is a very, very dangerous situation. And one of the most dangerous aspects is that we're not paying attention to this. The vast majority of people in this country favor the complete elimination of all nuclear weapons worldwide. But if you ask people to list, you know, the most important problems which are facing us, nobody mentions nuclear weapons anymore. And that has to change. People have to understand that these weapons continue to pose a real and present danger to our survival and that there is an urgent need that we eliminate them as rapidly as possible.
How do you imagine these conversations going forward in terms of negotiations? What do they look like?
Well, I think many non-nuclear weapon states around the world are basically fed up with the nuclear weapons powers. We have an obligation under Article 6 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty to negotiate for the elimination of our nuclear arsenals. And none of the nuclear weapon states are doing this, nor do they intend to do this at this point in time. and many of the non-nuclear weapon states, who will also be destroyed if there's a war between the nuclear powers, are now saying they've had enough of this. We are all party to this treaty. You nuclear weapon states have a legally binding obligation to negotiate the elimination of your arsenals, and you're not doing it. And in the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference, which will take place at the UN in early May, there's going to be a very loud demand from these non-nuclear weapon states that the United States, Russia, and the other countries which have nuclear weapons get serious, begin to honor their obligations. And if they don't, I suspect many of these nations are going to convene a conference outside of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and begin negotiations for a new treaty to ban nuclear weapons, to make them illegal, and to make those countries which possess those nuclear weapons essentially rogue states. There has been growing support for such a treaty over the last several years. Many countries around the world are now calling for such a treaty, and I think that's probably what's going to happen next.
All right, Dr. Helfand, thank you so very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Frank.
Dr. Ira Helfand is a physician and co-president of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. He's going to be speaking at the FedEx Global Education Center at UNC Chapel Hill Monday night at 7:30. We have more information at our website, stateofthings.org. And that's our program for today. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jess Clark is our intern. Brett Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.